Welcome to the Top M&A Entrepreneurs. Today, my guest is Jason Ehrlich from Fruition Cap. It's a fund to help self-funded searchers finance the acquisition of a deal. So we're going to talk about that. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Good. I really want to talk to you about this Fruition Cap. FruitionCap.com came on my radar recently, so I wanted to ask you about that. First of all, let's talk a little bit about Jason. Who is Jason? Where did this come from? And why did you start this company?
Yeah, sure thing, John. So I'm the kind of lead partner over at Fruition Capital. There's a few others that have been around the ETA and search space for a number of years, in addition to myself. My background kind of comes from various sort of corners of the alternative asset investment space, most recently and most notably commercial real estate. So I founded my first investment firm in that space, specifically around multifamily, around 6 years ago, after sort of investing as an LP, as a passive investor myself for a number of years. And in the last 6 or so years that I've been running that as a general partner, I've continued my own sort of LP investments in other alternative asset classes, you might say. And within the last year or so, came into this ETA, this searcher community in a really strong way. And got to know it quickly, got to love it quickly. And I saw that the search fund side of the world was pretty mature, but that the self-funded search side was growing like crazy, was still the Wild West, and really had a need for what we were trying to put together, which was a fund and a firm to support self-funded searchers, to write, you know, bigger checks, to be able to provide more ongoing support to those searchers that we worked with. So we kicked off Fruition Capital, and here we are.
When you say excited, you're talking about the returns that it could offer an investor?
Oh, it's far beyond that. I mean, I'm a big believer in small businesses like the backbone of the American economy, and it feels almost a little cliche to say, but when you look at the numbers, it's absolutely true. So yes, I think the financial returns are tremendous, but I also think the opportunity in supporting individual entrepreneurs to sort of facilitate this ownership transition as you have, you know, boomers holding a majority, over half of businesses in this kind of segment, we're talking about retiring, keeping these businesses in private hands, keeping the jobs in the community is like really important for us as a country. And so we're like very happy to contribute to that, in addition, of course, to making strong returns.
Yeah. So let's kind of talk about what that type of deal would look like. So first of all, I'm at your website called Fruition Cap, and you're going to allow the self-funded searcher. So tell me the difference between an independent sponsor and a self-funded searcher so people understand that.
Sure. So a self-funded searcher is someone who is going to go out there and find a business for themselves to own and operate. They're going to foot the bill for their search and the transaction costs. They personally guarantee the loan in most cases when they're taking down a deal. Usually they're looking at businesses in the, you know, half of a million to 2 million in EBITDA kind of range. And the economics for their deals are, you know, a bit different from what an independent sponsor might do. Independent sponsor is looking probably at a little bit bigger deals, and they tend to do a whole series of these types of deals where they put operators in place. They don't necessarily retain full ownership of the deal, and they're certainly not in there running the business day to day. Self-funded searchers traditionally are taking it down, buying it, operating it.
Yeah. Could they put somebody in that role?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So how do they retain full ownership up to 80%? That's when I'm looking at your website, it says, we're your investors, not your boss.
Yeah, that's true. So that's really in comparison against traditional search funds, right? Because let's say a recent MBA grad or anyone really who wants to go down the route of a traditional search fund, they'll get paid a salary for a couple of years from that search fund while they're searching. They don't have to worry about personally guaranteeing the debt or raising the equity. But when they acquire that business, the search fund will retain like 70% ownership and therefore full control. So at that point, the searcher becomes more or less a paid CEO, which I'm not knocking. That's great for some people. You know, obviously that route's held a lot of success. The folks that we're working with.
You're in the hot seat. You're in the hot seat. If you're not performing, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can be fired from the business that you went and bought. And the folks that we work with really want to be true owner operators. They don't want to necessarily be answerable to anybody. They want the autonomy. And our model is set up to respect that, to be able to, you know, have a board seat, be able to have visibility and add value where appropriate, but we're never going to put ourselves in a position where we have authority over the searcher. That's just not our model. That's not what self-funded search is all about.
So are you coming in? Can you tell me what that piece of the pie looks like? Is it skin in the game from the searcher? Is it funds from you guys? Is it earnout, seller financing, and some bank debt? Kind of like a private equity fund would do, like a searcher?
Yeah, the typical self-funded search deal structure involves mostly debt. I'll say around 80% typically, sometimes higher than that. Most commonly, we're talking about SBA debt. If it's a larger business, you know that some banks will do a second loan on top of that with concurrent current terms, pari passu loan, if you're familiar with that terminology. Some conventional debt in here, but I would say we see probably 75% SBA loans used. There's almost always some sort of seller carry that goes along with that SBA loan. And then the rest is equity. And most searchers either can't bring the amount of equity needed or don't want to. You know, they're already having enough exposure to one deal. So they'll go out and they'll raise some external equity. And that's where our firm and our fund really comes in is, you know, let's say our sweet spot is settling out in that $1.5 million to $2 million EBITDA. You might be raising about that amount in equity to facilitate the deal. And so we'll come in and we'll write a single check in the $600K to $800K range, which takes a lot of the stress out of the raise and, you know, kind of enables that searcher to go to other investors and say, hey, I've got an anchor investor. They've already been through all the operating agreements. They've diligenced the business. You know, do you want to come in and invest alongside of them?
Yeah, let's kind of talk about specifics and just anchor on a specific example. Like, it's doing 5 million top line and 1 million bottom line. What kind of company, how much due diligence do you dive into? Because here's what happens a lot of times. Self-funded searchers, they'll get the SIM, they'll get the financials, and the, you know, business broker, he boosts up the SDE saying, hey, there's $1 million here, but it's not really $1 million. What are you looking for, like the threshold debt service coverage ratio, debt to equity kind of to pass what you're looking for?
As it relates to the financials, I mean, we always will want to see a third party Q of E. And we don't have to have our own done. Q of E is quality of earnings for anyone not familiar with the acronyms. I know we speak in acronyms a lot. A quality of earnings report will go through there and have, you know, CPA firm actually audit, you know, the financials, and they will say, actually, these ad backs should be disallowed and all of that. So we'll want to make sure that the price that the operator's paying and the multiple that they're paying is not reflective of, you know, phantom income, for lack of a better term, income that shouldn't be included in that purchase price. And networking capital is a big important factor with that too. A lot of people, especially sellers in the lower side of the market, don't really understand how working capital plays as an important part of the business. So those are factors we want to make sure the searcher gets right up front. After that, you know, there's a series of ratios we want to look at. Debt service coverage ratio among them, you know, we want to see something that's north of probably like 1.75. I think in this particular space, that's pretty common. You know, I mentioned I come from real estate background. It's more like 1.25 there, but I think we see a lot
collateral.
More.
Yes,
that's right. A lot more collateral, and you see a lot more cash flow coming out of these businesses.
Yeah, the working capital. Do you see a lot of these small businesses? They always want to take the working capital out. Are you favor against of you know, SBA coming in and replacing the working capital or requiring the working capital to stay in the business?
No, in our view, working capital should always remain in the business. If it's not remaining in the business, the purchase price needs to be adjusted accordingly.
Right. Okay. So somebody brings you a great deal. It's $5 million top line, $1 million to bottom line. You go through a quality of earnings. Are we talking about a $15,000 quality of earnings person, like a top CPA firm, or $30,000, or?
Yeah, there's dozens of different firms that do them out there. And some firms will actually do more than just a quality of earnings. So one of the firms that we like to see, and we never dictate this to a searcher, right? Again, the searcher's in the driver's seat. We'll say, hey, if we're going to invest, we want to see a Q of E done. doesn't have to be from one of these top firms. And the same thing, you know, with the legal documents, right? You want to have competent representation there, but you don't need to go pay a national firm. We're not talking about acquiring a $100 million business. There are niche firms in our space that do this repeatably and in a reliable way at a reasonable price. So one, I'll just mention one firm off the top that we like to work with is Guardian Due Diligence, Elliott Holland. I think they charge a very reasonable fee, and they do more diligence than just the Q of E. It's more holistic, which we love to see their reports. So just one
Shout out. I have Elliot on. He's a good guest.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So when somebody brings you a deal and you go through these financials, is this the due diligence is out of the self-funded searcher's pocket, or is that bundled into the...
Yeah, most commonly self-funded searchers, by the, you know, the nature of self-funded, they're paying for these costs up front, but usually they'll have some provision in the deal that will be able to sort of recoup their costs that they've outlaid out of that.
So let's say Elliot does a great Q of A, and the customers say, we'll continue to keep buying from this searcher. You get the green light now. And does it already have, of course, we're into an LOI. Do you say that, I got to go back a little bit, because a lot of the times I've seen these self-funded searchers, they get ahead of themselves and offer a very high multiple to get the deal done.
We have a specific buy box, right? And if we are looking in this range of, let's say, 2 million, sub 2 million EBITDA, you know, we're not going to want to see a multiple north of, let's say, 4.5. Maybe 5 on the very top end if it's a $2 million business that has strong recurring revenue. If the multiple's north of that, the buyer's probably overpaying and it's not a deal we're going to get involved in. We commonly see deals in the 3.5 to 4 times range.
Yeah. And what kind of business is this? What niche sector is this for this buy box?
Now,
businesses? Yeah.
So our focus is exclusively on B2B companies. So we have this sort of enduringly profitable thesis that we subscribe to. So we're not looking for businesses that are, you know, a turnaround story that have been struggling. We're not looking for businesses that are on a crazy growth trajectory rocket ship thing. And we're certainly not looking for businesses that are so small that basically the entrepreneur is going to be buying a job more than they're buying an operating business. So B2B companies in that kind of north of a million EBITDA. We stay out of certain sectors, like they're very cyclical, so no energy, no tech, no construction. These things are either highly cyclical or highly disruptible in the case of technology, right? So we're just looking for those old economy type businesses that are dealing with the same customers year in, year out, very stable revenue. We don't have a specifically industry focus outside of the red flagged ones that I mentioned, and we don't have a specific geography. We actually like to get diversified on both of those sort of dimensions, geographically and by industry, as long as the business meets our sort of qualitative criteria.
Yeah. Just United States or Canada too?
Just
I got a lot of Canadian friends watch this show.
Yeah, yeah. We love you, Canada, but unfortunately the legal structure of our fund is only set up for domestic investment at this point.
Ah, all right. Sorry about that. So this enduringly profitable, that's a key word there that came from Richard Rubeck and Royce Yudkoff.
That's the HBR guide right there. Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
If you haven't read it, read it.
Yeah, it's a great book, Buying a Small Business, HBR Guide to Buying a Small Business. These are the guys that started RB Partners that kind of learned that, well, it's difficult to go out to do searchers. Why don't we hire these ambitious kids to go find the searchers and bring us the deal flow?
There you go. Now these ambitious kids are keeping, you know, 70% and they're owning it, and it's life changing in terms of lifestyle and the potential for generational wealth. So they were onto something for those kids.
Yeah. So let's go back into this. What is define an enduringly profitable business? Are we talking about 5%, 10%, or 15%, depending on the niche or sector?
Are you talking about in terms of recurring revenue?
Recurring revenue, one thing, but enduringly profitable, like the EBITDA is 15%. And it's, you know, in market comparison comps, it's good or better.
Enduringly profitable to me speaks to the fact that its EBITDA has been stable, its revenue has been stable or slightly growing for a long period of time. And you can point your finger at the reason why that is and why it should continue. So, you know, EBITDA will vary. You know, manufacturing has a certain band that it's within. Service businesses have a band that's slightly higher. So I'm not going to just point at a given EBITDA level. We want to see EBITDA that's sort of in line or above, if you know, possible, with what that sector's doing. But enduringly profitable isn't about, oh yeah, your EBITDA margin is good. It's about you've been producing it in a stable way over time. You have the same people buying from you over and over again. And I can look at the business and I can say, okay, I see that you are a critical piece of this value chain. And I can see why you're, let's just pick one example of a competitive barrier here. I can see that you're a really small piece of this big cost structure over here, but it'd be really expensive to sort of push you out and put somebody else in. So I can explain why they keep buying from you over and over again. And I have reasonable belief that that's going to happen into the future. That's enduringly profitable in my mind.
Yeah. Let me give you an example and you make a call on this. It's an HVAC company doing $5 million in a very large metropolitan area like Phoenix. It's year round. Everybody needs AC and heating in Phoenix because its average temperature is pretty high. So 50% of his business is commercial B2B, but 50% is residential. How would you look at that?
Yeah. So for our particular thesis, we're very B2B centric. So just with my own sort of Fruition Fund hat on, that's not a deal we're going to do because the residential mix is just too high. Now, can a business like that be enduringly profitable? Do you have a big enough base of commercial clients there generating enough revenue to where you can go out there and scratch and claw for the what I know to be very competitive retail business? You can. It's just a little too far towards that B2C end of the market for us.
Yeah. Are you looking for some kind of threshold like 70% would be B2B and reoccurring?
I'll say that everything we have now is pretty much exclusively B2B. When I say recurring, it doesn't necessarily have to be that your clients are on long-term contracts, but we see the same list of clients buying from you over and over year after year after year. So your customer churn is very low. I think that if we had a business that was doing, let's say, 80% and they just had a small mix of B2C sort of in there, we would take that on a case-by-case basis. But yeah, mostly it's exclusive.
Yeah. Let me ask you, for instance, back to that HVAC example. And one of the individuals I was talking about, I think he's already talked to you, but he had the acquisition that he has in LOI has long-term commercial contracts, B2Bs, with you know, restaurants, fast food restaurants, et cetera. But it's not reoccurring revenue. He has maintenance agreements, maybe $500 a month with 40, 50, but it's reoccurring, but that's not a big portion of the revenue. It's when the freezer goes down that he has to go replace it. And those freezers are very expensive.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. So if you've got a business like that where because you've put in the actual recurring revenue, you have a relationship with them, you're their go-to provider, and they're going to come to you when those big ticket items happen. That's my point. That can be enduringly profitable because that same customer, whenever the big ticket item does happen, they come and they buy from you.
Yeah. Let me go back to your list on your website, and you talk about not cyclical, definitely understandable about that, but also or technology centric.
Yeah.
So you're not touching technology kind of companies, kind of what the Warren Buffett used to say. I'm not touching technology because I don't understand it. But he's got money into Apple and other companies now.
Yeah, I guess his understanding is improving. Listen, it's obviously a vital sector of our economy. It has potential for explosive growth, right? But it is also highly disruptible. When you look at tech, few names are able to go out there and produce, you know, reliable earnings over and over and over again. There's a few giants, right? And they garner crazy multiples. I don't even want to know what Apple's trading at on a multiple basis. It's not four times.
It's probably 30, I think.
It's not four and a half, right? So for us, you know, certain models, SaaS type models, you know, they would check a lot of the boxes for recurring revenue, business clients and all that, but they are subject to disruption. Tech is constantly changing, evolving. You know, we're in the first inning of generative AI right now, and there's all this, you know, media attention about the jobs that it'll displace and all of that. I think about something like that could walk into a whole series of software-based, technology-based offerings and just make them obsolete, you know, with the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of existential risk that we're just not taking.
Yeah. There's 100 million people use ChatGPT every day now.
Yeah, and it's been out for, less than a year or something like that?
Less than a year. So let's talk about the operator. Who does this look like? I know it's a self-funded searcher.
Yeah.
Are you asking the self-funded searcher to bring their own skin in the game? And what is that? How much is that?
Yeah. So let me talk about the operator, the entrepreneur first, and then we'll talk about sort of the structure with that.
Yeah.
So we went through our business acquisition criteria, and that criteria is not really flexible, as you probably got when you were poking it on a couple dimensions. Our entrepreneur criteria is far more flexible. You know, there are several key skill sets that you need to run a business, right? You've got to be able to lead, manage, and inspire people, because business at the end of the day, it's people and systems, right? So you've got to have the people aspect of it. You've got to be able to manage, you know, a P&L end to end, because that's what a business is, right? You've got to have sort of a strategic vision for where that thing is going to go. But you can get that from a lot of places. So, you know, we like to see people that have an MBA. We like to see people that have, you know, a decade or more of professional experience, but it's not all mandatory. You know, we have people, operators that are, you know, we've invested in them. They're in our fund that, you know, meet those dimensions. And we have people that started and ran their own business, exited it, are now doing another business. Well, guess what? I couldn't care less if you have an MBA. You've proven you can do what we're talking about. Or people that have been in a, let's say it's kind of a corporate role, but they've managed people. They've been responsible for a P&L. We can get a comfort level from talking to them that they have what it takes to run the business. So it's a lot more subjective. A lot more people can do it. The second part of your question was, what does that look like? What do they need to bring to the deal? So certainly in the instance where they're personally guaranteeing the debt, SBA loans in particular, that goes a long way. We always like to see some kind of co-investment, but you know, it can be sort of a token thing. We're talking about maybe $50,000 or something like that. If it's not recourse debt, if they're using some other provider and their name is not on the loan, then we certainly want to see much more significant skin in the game from an equity investment perspective.
Yeah. I got a question for you about that. You know, maybe even if it does meet the MBA, maybe he was a special operator managing people in the services. Maybe he was an executive, something like, did you ever get a sense what they know what the bell rings, but the personality clashes coming through these interviews that like, I'm just not going to have them in my, I'm not going to put them in front of my investors.
No, that's why I talk about it. It's more subjective, right? We've got to be able to believe that this is someone who is a high character, high integrity person who's going to be good at working with people, employees and customers, because that's what it takes to succeed in business. And even if the resume looks good, if somebody's not coming off and exuding that vibe that they can do that, it's an immediate red flag. It's the side of our model that relies a lot more on your gut, and we listen to ours.
Yeah. Do you do any background checks on the individual?
Not formal. You know, we're not engaging third parties to go digging through anybody's, you know, credit report. But we definitely like to talk to
criminal records. Yeah.
We definitely like to talk to people that have been in their sphere, whether it's people that have worked for, bosses that they've had. You know, we like to get some points of reference to sort of triangulate on the character.
Yeah. All right. So you've got, let's say you have a great operator, self-funded searcher, brings you a very nice deal and it checks all the boxes, right?
So it's a good day.
Yeah, it's a good day, right? And it's a good essential industry niche. And, you know, it's been around for 10, 15 years, whatever. And the guy wants to retire, you know, a reasonable multiple, great debt service coverage ratio. So is this a fund that you guys have in like a bank account? You can write a check immediately? Or is this a, you know, I've got to get this deck and the story out to a number of high net worth individuals in a network?
No. So we operate through a fund model. We are raising the capital ahead of getting the actual deals done. So we're not going out with, you know, pitching each individual deck. We sort of have the whole thesis that we've pitched. It's out there with our investor group. Every investor, so I'll take off my sort of searcher facing hat for a minute and put on my investor facing hat, right? If I'm an investor who's thinking about accessing this asset class, I can write a single check and get immediate exposure to these 6 to 8 deals that we'll put in each fund, right? And I'll get diversified across geographies and across industries. From the searcher's perspective, they don't have to go out there, at least not with us, because again, we don't take up the whole cap table. We like to be 40%, maybe 50% of a searcher's cap table. So they will have to still go out there with the deal specific pitch deck and raise some additional equity. Again, we can kind of help with that. We have a network of folks that like to invest alongside us, but we are not taking that deck and going and pitching it. We have the capital lined up in the fund that we'll invest.
And what are you asking yourself for? How much are you on the cap table? You said 40 to 50%.
We like to take up 40 to 50% of the cap table, the equity side.
And are you any other preferred? Is this preferred shares? And
we go along the same sort of standard terms that you see in the self-funded search space. So it's a participating preferred instrument. So we'll have a preferred return that's, let's say, between 11 and 14%, depending on kind of the deal dynamics.
And that's a coupon that would start immediately if it's cash flowing, or is there some kind of suspension?
No, immediately upon closing, it starts accruing the preferred return. We strongly prefer businesses that have a cash flow profile that will pay that out current. We'll entertain
a structure. That's where you get the 1.75.
Right. That's right. Yeah. But we will entertain a structure where part of it is deferred. We don't ever want to have a fully just accrued pref that's not getting paid off at all. Once the pref is paid off and our principal is returned, at that point, those preferred shares typically convert to common. There's usually a step-up basis where 1.5 to 2, let's say, that preferred return goes away. And we just participate in the distributions and the upside on the business kind of on a pro rata basis with the operator from that point.
Yeah. Are you looking for individuals that have a bigger goal of, let's say, I'm going to do a roll up, or are you just looking for an individual that wants to buy a $5 million business and operate it for the next 10, 20 years?
So we've done both. I'll say that roll ups introduce incremental risk, right? Acquisition is inherently time consuming, dangerous, deals break, integration risk. So if it is a roll-up strategy, we usually like the terms to be a little more investor favorable to compensate us for the risk of going along with all of those subsequent acquisitions. You were describing the perfect scenario a few minutes ago for the deal that I'll do. The perfect scenario is the business is doing about $2 million in EBITDA. That's south of where private equity really wants to get involved, but $3 million is very interesting to small private equity. And so if you buy a business that's doing $2 million and you operate it competently for 5, 6, 7 years, you've probably grown it to a point where it's doing about $3 million organically without a lot of the risk of bolt-ups and bolt-ons and roll-ups and all of that. So
yeah, I mean, for instance, in the HVAC industry, if I'm in Tucson, you're not going to grow past Tucson unless you're buying another business in Phoenix.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We want to make sure that there's a comfortable exit strategy. And if you're buying at $2 million, the exit strategy is you can do nothing, grow it organically, and have a nice exit to private equity. If you're buying a business that's $1 million or south of $1 million, you're probably going to have to do a lot of work and if you want your exit multiple to be better than your entry multiple. But long story short, we'll definitely invest in both strategies and have.
So if the preferred's paid off and you convert your pref to common, are you looking for some kind of liquidation event for them, or would you hold, buy and hold forever?
So we have a provision that we put in because we're operating out of a fund structure. We could have need for liquidity. So we put a provision in the operating agreement with our searchers that says, hey, if you haven't sold the business after 5 years, we have what amounts to a put option where we can basically force you to buy us out should we need to exercise that for liquidity. It's not our preferred exit. We would definitely rather hang with people for the long haul. And certainly we can't enforce anything before the 5-year time horizon, but we do kind of put that optionality in there in case we need it.
Yeah. So I know that this fund is fairly new and you probably haven't had that happen yet, right?
We have not.
Yeah. And if you have a portfolio of, 10, 15, essential businesses with a minority shareholder, is this a portfolio that you could sell off to somebody, or are you just talking about buy and holding like Warren Buffett for the rest of your life?
No. So the fund in and of itself, we will raise and deploy capital in the first year, and then the acquisition stops. And at that point we're holding and we're just providing support to our operators. We're not trying to turn around and sell our interests. In many cases, I think the operating agreements may prohibit us from doing something like that. So our ambition is just to be on the cap table, be there, support the entrepreneurs through their hold. Many of them will choose to exit one way or another inside of that, let's say, 7-year horizon. And those that don't, if we need to get bought off the cap table at that point, you like to hope and assume the business will be doing sufficiently well where that's not hard to do. And at that point, the entrepreneur can own the business outright.
Yeah. Do you get a board seat with this this equity?
Yeah. Almost always. Yeah, almost always we do.
And what kind of strategic guidance are you sharing with the individual?
Oh, gosh. So that's a broad topic. We have a number of different sort of components of expertise on our general partner team. So for myself, I did a number of years in management consulting, and obviously we see a lot of small business. So I can personally advise on sort of a whole range of different business topics, whether it's trying to grow the top line or improve operations or whatever. We have folks on our board that are EOS, which is the Entrepreneurial Operating System, if your audience is familiar with that. We have a member who's very expert in those implementations, so we can provide guidance on that. Another of our GP team is actually an operator, a searcher now turned operator himself, so he can provide all manner of anecdotes. It really kind of runs the gambit. We're not providing like paid advisory services for the operators. We're there, invested in the deal. We're members of the board. We're sort of providing guidance as they request it. And some businesses, the searchers, the entrepreneurs, very autonomous and is happy to sort of give us visibility into what's going on, but doesn't ask for our opinion a lot. And as long as things are going well, we're fine with that. Others are very happy to have our expertise and will ask us questions and will ask us to, put together recommendations for things. And again, we're more than willing to do that too.
Yeah. Is that kind of a partner on call kind of deal, or is that every 3 months a board meeting required?
Well, yeah, we like to see a cadence of the board meetings where there's updates, there's a little report on what's going on in the business, but then we're also available on call should there be some business challenge they want to talk through or opportunity they want to talk through.
All right, so let's go to the investors that are putting money into this fund. They're high net worth individuals, and you did what kind of raise was it? It's a 506 Reg D?
506C, yeah.
506C, okay. So what these high net worth individuals, they always have alternative investment opportunities, and they're going to look for the highest return, lowest risk. What does that look like when you present to them and say, hey, would you like to join the fund? We're buying Main Street businesses. Here's what the return looks like.
Yeah, that's not our pitch, right? We're not saying, hey, it's the highest return with the lowest risk. We think there is a very attractive risk-return profile here. When you look at the stats around failure rates, let's say for these acquisition businesses, you look at the SBA loan failure rates are lower than 4%. You look at some of the research out there that says, of these, the segment that we're in, more than 90% of the businesses acquired, they either maintain the EBITDA at the level it's at or they increase it. So 10% or fewer are actually even having a decrease in EBITDA, much less going under. So we think that sort of that risk adjusted return is definitely there, but I think it goes beyond that. This is providing, key liquidity into Main Street, like we talked about. We're investing in small businesses. We're keeping jobs in communities. So I think there's definitely, an impact element here that a lot of our investors, we get through all of the financials and the risk metrics and all of that. They feel good about that. But then there's also this incremental layer of sort of doing well by doing good, if you'll, pardon the cliche. But no, we do think that, with our approach of, putting, let's say, 8 different deals in a fund and diversifying it across geographies and across sectors, it takes that already kind of good failure rate and it blends it even further to make that risk adjusted return look better.
So you have to have for the, well, I was like to say this right, for for this fund to have kind of the returns that an investor is looking for, you know, both with the heart and the head, you got to have about 8 of these types of companies in the fund.
Well, I wouldn't say that, right? So we only deploy, we call in and deploy our capital once we have an opportunity ready. So I could have commitments all the way up to my 5 million, but I'm not going to ask each individual investor to wire in their funds until we're ready to put that money to work. And so let's just say hypothetically, and we're already past this, so it wouldn't happen, but let's say we only raised half of the capital. We'd only do 4 deals and the returns would be the same because we're sort of matching capital coming into deals. So we'd never get into a scenario where our deal funnel doesn't keep up with our capital raise.
Yeah. Let me ask you about these investors again. Now, they're clearly investing in Main Street businesses, right? Essential Main Street businesses. Are they sometimes you get these requests from like, hey, I'm looking for the Uber type returns, the 30% plus and really high multiple on invested capital?
Well, I mean, I know those investors are out there. We don't have a lot of those conversations because our materials and our thesis is pretty clear, right? We're not looking for the unicorns or the rocket ships or whatever you want to talk about. This is not the high risk, you know, make or break kind of model. This is a lot closer to, if I think about commercial real estate as an asset class for my own, you know, parallels, this is the multifamily building that's diversified. It's got stable revenue and it kind of chugs along and does what you think it's going to do over time. It's the business version of that, which certainly has more risk than real estate, like we talked about, but significantly more upside. And so the investors that are trying to do startup investing or seed round venture or some of these more, you know, I know 90% of them will fail, but the 10% that go are going to do 100x. And so it's worthwhile. That's a great investment thesis and plenty of people have gotten rich doing it. It's not our approach. And I think those people kind of get that right off the bat. So people that come to us, they're looking for more stability. They want growth. They want returns, but they also like preservation of capital. They like to have kind of some of the tax efficiency that comes with direct ownership and they like to have cash flow.
Yeah. What does that IR look like for somebody like this? Is it in the 20, 30 range or?
It's in the mid 20s is what we're projecting at the fund level. I'll say that, you know, since your audience is investors and searchers, when we are underwriting a deal at the search level, at the deal level, we're underwriting it more to the mid-30s. And we want to be able to put in sort of conservative assumptions around what revenue growth is going to look like, what operating margins are going to look like, what the exit multiple is going to look like. But then I turn around and I sort of shave that down further when I talk to my LPs. We are a fund that always likes to overpromise or underpromise and overdeliver, to say that the right way. So yes, we're talking about mid-20s, we're underwriting to mid-30s and, you know, hoping to beat on projections.
Let me ask you about that, the word conservative. I remember a long time ago somebody, an investor told me to stop using the word conservative because it means different things to different people.
Sure.
But if you're buying an HVAC company and it's perfect, you know, 1.75 debt service coverage ratio. It looks beautiful, but they're historically only grown 5% a year, mm-hmm. year in, year out. Like,
yeah.
How are you getting a 25, 30, maybe tapping IRR for an investor for something that's only grown at 5%?
It has to do with the economics, right? If your purchase multiple is attractive enough and your operating margins are good, even if you just do continue growing at that same kind of rate, as long as the investors are getting the right proportion of the deal relative to their capital, you can absolutely achieve that kind of exit. I think that's the magic of this space. That's the magic of buying on a very low multiple. And I think, again, the scenario that we look for is one where, you know, ideally you're not trying to exit at the exact same multiple that you bought at in 5 to 7 years. Ideally, you've grown. You're going to try to do a little bit better on that exit. We're not counting on a lot of that. But I think that can happen in a majority of these cases. So really, it doesn't take a ton, especially because these deals are leveraged with pretty good debt, right? It doesn't take a ton to make the returns pretty attractive.
Yeah, the debt would magnify the returns. But let's say, you know, you got these levers, right? You're looking for this return on the back end here. Have you ever gone back to the operator and the deal and say, hey, man, your multiple's a little bit higher, or we have to bring in more equity or more debt?
Yeah, I mean, we absolutely provide feedback on the underwriting, and we're not asking them to necessarily change their own underwriting, but we might say, hey, you know, you're offering a step up that's 1.4. And with our assumptions and, you know, what we're willing to give you as far as exit multiple expansion, as far as revenue growth, you're going to have to give us a 1.7 for this to make economic sense for us. And they don't have to change anything in their deal terms. They may just have to give us a little bit bigger piece of the pie. And again, I say a little bit because in no case do we ever take more than 19% of a business. You know, that's an SBA threshold for getting into personal guarantee territory, which the fund won't do. So we're always going to remain minority partners, but you may have to adjust the terms a little bit if, you know, the deal economics aren't stellar, let's say.
Yeah, let's talk a little sidebar on that, the step up, because a lot of people didn't come from private equity or venture capital to understand what that step up means to the searcher. And it definitely, we know what it means to the buyer or the investor, because they're going to make, it's a sweetener. It's more dollar. Yeah. But tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's designed to say, hey, investor, you know, thank you for taking a chance on me here. And basically, we're going to put you further, you know, into the money at the moment that your shares convert from preferred to common. So, you know, if the business were to sell a day after that conversion, that the investors would make money. Again, like I mentioned, the common sort of terms that we're seeing are between 1.5 and 2x step up.
Yeah, and so given, that's a given, so if an investor puts a dollar in at a participating preferred, it converts to 1.5, $1.50 at some kind of liquidation event.
That's right.
Okay, cool. Jason, thank you so much for being on the show. How can they get in touch with you if they have a great, if they're a great operator and they have a great deal?
Yeah, absolutely. So the easiest way to reach me is just via email, jason@fruitioncap.com. That's jason@fruitioncap.com. Obviously, our website is fruitioncap.com. We've got our deal, you know, criteria and things that we've talked about on the podcast are listed out there today. If you're an investor and, you know, our fund sounds interesting, fruition.com/investors has a whole bunch of details sort of on the investor facing side of the fund. And you can reach me via email as well.
Perfect. Thanks for being on the show, Jason.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
I hope this video has inspired you. If you need help buying your first $1 million business, make sure to visit me at dealflowsystem.net. If you like this video, make sure you subscribe down below. Comment on it, share it, tell everyone about it. And thanks for watching.